My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 75. Hello, my friends. On every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be behind this microphone talking to you about such things? Well, I have been an independent author and self-publisher and, publisher in a number of different media since the late 1980s. If you're thinking about things in the more modern sense, in terms of ebooks and things like that, I've been doing it since 2005, when I published the first novel in history with a simultaneous initial release in ebook, paperback, and free podcast edition. Since then, I've got about a dozen titles on the market, and my day job is helping other creators, especially authors and some podcasters, bring their own works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. I like to start off by filling you in on what I've been up to in terms of my creative writing life since we last spoke. Today is March 15th, 2023. It's a little later than I would have liked to be recording this because the episode's supposed to come out on March 15th. Every Wednesday, we've been doing this for a while now. But yeah, here we are. And what's been going on? Well, a few episodes back, I talked about the ultimate perfect writing software, especially fiction writing software, in my mind, at least. And I spent an episode kind of describing it, talking about what it should be and how it would work and how it would be different from the other options that are out there on the market. And come to find out, I may have had something right under my nose all along. I just didn't understand enough about how it works. It's not technically a fiction writing piece of software like Scrivener or YWriter or something like that. It is a personal knowledge management software. It's called Obsidian, and I'm going to spend more time talking about it probably in a future episode once I've got my things kind of all sussed out with it. But I've been spending a lot of time in this last week learning more about what Obsidian can do and how it can be configured to do almost everything that I want from a writing software application. So I've been playing around with that quite a bit. I also spent a lot of my free and creative time, my non-work, non-taking care of personal stuff time in this last week, preparing the interview that you're going to hear in just a few minutes. Every other episode of Sonatotum features an interview with a creative person from various stages in their career. It took a long time. Recording the interview takes about an hour and a half, and then going through and taking that hour and a half of raw material and editing it down to something that is coherent and directed and has as much value as possible for you, dear listener, that takes considerable time, anywhere from 6 to 8 hours. So it's a lot of work, and that's what I've been doing since, I think I started tinkering on Friday, and I finished the editing of the actual conversation a couple days ago. Yeah, so my creative time this week has been spent both in preparing something that could be very useful for my creativity, and in preparing something that I hope is very useful for you in your creative life, which is the upcoming conversation with Joyce Reynolds Ward. Joyce Reynolds Ward is a cross-genre author whose work includes themes of high-stakes family and political conflict, digital sentience, personal agency, features realistic strong women, and frequently includes settings in the Pacific Northwest. Some of her works, at least as of March 2023, as I record this, include a number of series, the Netwalk Sequence, the Goddess's Honor series, several different series in her Martineer universe, and a number of standalone books and shorter works. Joyce Reynolds Ward is the secretary of the Northwest Independent Writers Association. She's a member, as am I, of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association, and she's a member of the Sore Optimists International. As always, I will have plenty of links in the show notes for this episode over there at mattselznick.com/sonitotum-75. And of course, you can find everything about Joyce Reynolds Ward if you want to go directly to joycereynoldsward.com. Let's get into the conversation. So I like to start off by asking, what do you create?
I write science fiction and fantasy stories. The settings are roughly the Pacific Northwest, although I'm currently working on a far future thing set in another planet and galactic central, et cetera, et cetera. I tend to use a lot of Western themes and tropes because I am a Pacific Northwest U.S. resident. I identify very heavily with the North American West, more so than I do with Europe, even though my cultural origins trace back to Europe. When you're picking up my things, you're going to find not only a lot of women, and I'm working on bringing in more diverse supporting casts, not perfect at it. I don't know if I'll ever get perfect at it. But it's all going to be kind of shaped from that West Coast of North American perspective, specifically the Pacific Northwest as opposed to the California West Coast.
The other thing that I like to ask directly related to that is, why do you create?
I like telling stories. The first thing I really remember writing was borrowing my dad's typewriter and typing out some sort of fan fiction about Mighty Mouse. And then I got older and there would be these TV shows that I would get really involved with that I would tell myself stories about. And I was really into horse stories at the time. I got tired of reading horse stories that had boy lead characters. And so I rewrote the classic horse story of that era, which is somehow you manage to find or breed or train the ideal candidate to win the Triple Crown. Only in this case, it was a girl and a female horse, not a stallion, but a mare. And she was a Palomino. I mean, it was total wish fulfillment. But my parents used to spend every weekend going fishing at a place on the other side of the Cascades, which was about a 2 to 3 hour drive. And so I would spend the drive telling myself stories. And that just kind of continued.
My first stories were on my grandfather's old Royal manual typewriter from the early 30s, so which I still have. It has a place of honor. it needs to be repaired, but yeah. So yeah, I can completely relate to that. And of course, retelling and adjusting and doing what we would now call fan fiction with, for me, it was comic books. And there was a song, Thunder Island, that was on the radio for a little while in the 70s. And of course, I wrote a little story about that because, oh yeah, we're off to Thunder Island. That sounds exciting and adventurous. And, you know, but you like telling stories, but what do you think drove that? What do you think sparked that instead of painting or drawing or some other expression?
I read a lot as a kid. And at some point that moved into wanting to tell stories. I'm not particularly artistic. I took piano lessons like I think just about every young woman of my in the 60s and 70s can probably tell you a story about being forced to take piano lessons. And I rapidly figured out that I enjoy singing and everything, but I was not cut out to be a musician. I hadn't learned about quilting, and I kind of hated sewing. So storytelling was something I could do when I climb on my pony and go riding, or climb on my horse and go riding. And so I would.
Did you have that epiphany moment of, oh, wait, other people wrote these. I could do that. Or was it always kind of in the back of your mind that, of course, other people wrote these?
It was always in the back of my mind. I started writing that one horse story when I was in fifth grade. Then I ended up for about 2 or 3 years subjecting my classmates to, hey, can I read this to you at the end of the
I did the same thing. Yeah. Did the same thing. And I would, of course, put very loosely based versions of them in the stories. And yeah, I'd pass them around on the school bus. I'm right there with you. Yep.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Pacific Northwest and elements of the Pacific Northwest. And I immediately thought of my favorite, technically a novel, more of a story cycle, by Ursula K. Le Guin, Always Coming Home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Although hers was more Northern California, but it was very much the same sort of impulse, because Ursula, you know, I've read her work very extensively, and she had a very strong identification with a family property in the Central Valley. I think it was kind of in the mountainous edge of the Central Valley. And so it's very much reflected, especially in Always Coming Home, though, you know, the Lathe of Heaven is very much a Portland story.
That's right. Yeah.
She brought in Portland awareness into a bunch of her other work. For me, keep in mind that I'm a fifth generation Pacific Northwest resident on my mother's side. My family has always been poor dirt farmers. Other than the general culture, I don't have any particular family traditions. No ties back to the old country.
Right. This is your old country.
Yeah, this is my old country.
Five generations. Yes, of course. Yes. It sounds like one way or the other, stories are in your blood, and it's an impulse that can't be denied.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, if I'm sitting around somewhere and I don't want to like be messing with my phone, or if I'm just kind of marking time, I'll just sit there and tell myself a story.
Sure.
I do a lot of my daydreaming world building stuff when I just don't have other things to do.
World building is something I'm in love with myself. Where my current works are focused and where my focus is right now is loosely defined a fantasy setting, but I am not a big fan of genre restrictions and genre tropes. It's a non-technology setting, but it's not Earth. It's not medieval anything. It's not. And you have to think about all these things, right?
And these days, I really do have a difficult time picking up, oh, yet another medieval fantasy.
Yes.
No, I think my Goddess's Honor series is more the late 1700s, early 1800s Pacific Northwest in some ways. It's not our world. It's a different one. And they have magic and there's different technologies. But castles, there is a stone structure that was built in the 1400s, 1500s in the Southwest in a place called Hovenweet that they call a castle. And I looked at it and went, okay, that's kind of similar.
I guess if it serves the same defensive, centralized role in the region at the time, sure, it's a castle. You know? But yeah, they're not going to have the same building materials necessarily. They're not going to have the same building architecture philosophy, you know, it's
climate.
Or climate. Thank you so much. Yes, yes. And I don't know about you, but it's real easy to get into the proverbial and literal weeds on this stuff, figuring things out like that. Like, okay, well, not just what's the latitude of where my story takes place, but now I got to think about, you know, if you want to go that deep, and I kind of do, there's a verisimilitude that can be implied in the writing. If you, the author, kind of know enough of this stuff to understand what the implications would be. Like knowing that the moon is very close and very fast and very small. So that changes calendars and what's the visibility like at night and all these different things and cultural things too. Do you find yourself sometimes going a little too far down the rabbit hole at the expense of or to the detriment of writing time?
Not really, because the characters start grabbing at me.
Yeah.
The one I just finished 3 years with, it was going to be just a standalone. I was going to go to World Fantasy. I was going to pitch it because it was going to be agricultural technology-based science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having one character grab me by the throat and say, "That's not what happened. And this is why." And so it became this whole complicated thing about an exiled heir, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But all this at the same time, I never really, well, I had a very rich development on it. Some people will sit down and they will create sheet upon sheet of character lists and references and descriptions. And I am more inclined to sit down. And if I'm trying to work something like that out, at some point, what I will do is I will take my characters and I will throw them into a situation and write a short story about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The Goddesses Honor series has a lot of short stories, novelettes, and novellas, because that was how I somewhat fleshed out the world. My response has never been to just go into massive amounts of it, but to write a short story. Or I have one of these easels that you get from the kids department at IKEA that has a whiteboard on one side, a chalkboard on the other, but
oh, yeah.
It has those that continuous paper feed. I will sit there and just start brainstorming aspects, relationships of so-and-so to so-and-so. That's usually a day's work. And then I transcribe it into Scrivener and I'm off and writing.
We have a similar process. I think of it as story buds, because you might start off with one thing and like a coral reef, some little thing will bud off. It's like, well, wait a minute. Before that tertiary character came into the room, they mentioned they had been at this one place. Huh. Well, what happened there? And all of a sudden, and every little tertiary budded story you start to think about, by default, you start to flesh out the world because each story is asking a different question. Also, similar to your double-sided easel thing, I will just start a sheet of paper and present something that I do know about whatever it might be, with the world or the character or whatever. And I'll play the four-year-old game. But why? Answer that question. Exactly. And then, but why?
I look at the setting and character sheets that some people absolutely swear by, and I kind of go, nothing.
Too rigid. I don't need to know their favorite color, what they have in their pockets. I'll be able to answer that on the fly because I know who they are by this more organic expression. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what really gets weird is when the character suddenly throws something at you like, I wonder what would have happened if this had gone differently.
And that's the lovely thing when you're able to really get to know these folks. That's why when some writers are like, oh, I hate killing off characters, I'm like, why? You've got every moment in their life before they died that you can always go back and tell a story about. There's no there's no limit there.
And if I get really tired of writing about these characters, there's kind of a Yellowstone-ish type backstory.
Mm-hmm. See, a lifetime of stories. We'll never have enough time to tell them all. So sort of the three pillars of Sonatotum, I know I mentioned this, but it's making stuff, finding success as we each define it, and staying healthy and sane in the process. So what is success to you? How do you define success for yourself as a creator, as a writer, as an author? And do you feel like you're there? Are you approaching it? How's that going?
Oh, it depends. I have some very dedicated fans, so that is one form of success. But critical success, I'll be honest, I would dearly love to win an award or two. Realistically, is that going to happen? Probably not. I write too much out of the box. And while my, it's like the last time I ran one of the Martinier, which is the series I've been working on the last 3 years. I ran one of those books through the self-published science fiction competition. And both times it bounced off very hard. But one reviewer fell in love with it. And his comment was, hey, this is different. This is really different. If you want something that's really different, come read it. But I've come to accept the fact that, yeah, I am in that niche. At best, I will probably always be a semifinalist. But damn, I'd love to dream about being the winner.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because you said what you do is a little out of the box. Do you mean that you're not perfectly within the ranges of the expected tropes, or how do you describe that?
I don't fit within the range of the expected tropes.
Yeah.
Now, I might have had more success with my fantasy with the first book of the Goddesses Honor series, Pledges of Honor, which did pick up a self-published fantasy blog off semifinalist position. But I had female lead characters. It was a non-European setting. And when I was sending it out to publishers before I went the self-publishing route, it was getting the rejections of love your voice, love your work, can't sell it. Because the non-European Western setting was just different enough.
That was the killer, huh?
I think that and the female character. With the Martinier books, they're near future, they're agricultural, but there's not a niche for it. Like the guy said, oh, it started out like a thriller and then it took a hard left into a ranch romance and then it turned into something else. And so there's not really a niche. I mean, I actually have started comparing myself to Ivan Doig and Willa Cather.
Mm.
And I might even bring John Steinbeck into it.
Why not? I mean, if that's the fit. See, if anyone who knows me knows that I will at the drop of a hat, get up on that hat if I don't have a soapbox nearby and scream about how much I hate genre distinctions and genre silos.
Mm-hmm.
I think... Well, I could go on, and there's an old podcast episode that I could probably just refer you to and save us both some time. But but I run into the same trouble, and it's literally a hard sell. So what do you do to find that reader community? I mean, I rather glibly drop the phrase all the time. I make things for people who like the kinds of things I make. But what do you, in your own writing and in your own marketing, how are you reaching the readers who need to be reached, who should be reading what you're writing?
One of the biggest problems I've run into is COVID, because I really started that particular series and some of this focusing on readers I knew in the inland Northwest. And here, you know, getting feedback, well, we really don't have anything that talks about our setting. And so I do a little blogging. I do a little things like this. I talk to people about it. And I've just come to the conclusion it's a slow build. We have a local literary organization that is well regarded, Fish Trap. I've tried networking with that, but they're really hard into the literary box. And first of all, I'm not one of these people who goes, ew, literature, because I don't believe in those boxes.
No,
I really don't. I've always been someone who read widely. You know, if you really want to get me going on somebody like John Steinbeck, Ursula, Willa Cather, one of the best sustained descriptions I have ever read was The Song of the Lark. That's the kind of thing you can learn by reading widely.
Of course. Reading critically. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned dedicated fans. That's just sort of aggregate over the years, or did you have a strategy to get to them? Is that
aggregate over the years, going to conventions and networking with people and talking to people and just being friendly, being social, and eventually them picking up my books and going, oh, yeah, we really like this. I can't explain how it happens, but it does. There are some people who really click, and I'm very grateful for that.
Right, indeed. So tying a bow around the finding success and defining it for yourself, apart from the unrealized goal of the award, do you feel like you're on the path where you should be? I don't think any of us will ever, if we're really driven to create as you are, I don't think you're ever completely where you should be. But do you feel as if things are going the way you want them to?
I think so. It's going to be slow. And I'm kind of reaching that age where it's kind of like I'm going, well, we'll see how much I can get done.
Yeah, I'm going to be 56 and I'm already thinking of those things, too. It's like, well, maybe there's 25. 30 good years. Maybe there's one. Who knows? That's the thing. You know, maybe there's a week.
My friend and mentor, Phyllis Irene Radford, is 71. And she is still like, oh, well, I have this story in mind. And I have that story in mind. And she's working on her 50th book.
Right. Yep. Yep. You just got to keep going and perhaps give some thought to legacy, like what will become of those untold stories. And when you deal in story worlds, as you've created these couple of universes now and probably have ideas for many more, have you thought about bringing other people into those worlds, having other folks finish stories if you may not be able to or anything like that?
Not really, because to this point in time, I don't have that big a following.
Right.
And so I don't know that there would be anybody that would be interested in taking it on.
Sure.
That could change. You never know. Mm-hmm. The next book might change it. Or it might not, but just the fact that I have had people who have really fallen in love with my book work makes me feel good.
Yeah. I often say that it's not really art until someone other than the person who made it has experienced it. And that the whole thing, the reader-writer thing, is a collaboration between peers, really, because we need each other. We can't really complete the circuit without the other.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah.
And so that in itself is very, very gratifying. All right, so let's talk a little bit about process, about your best practices, about the things that you've kind of figured out that help you be productive and balance a creative writing life with, well, everything else. What do you do to stay healthy and sane in the process of pursuing those goals and creating that life?
Making myself get up and move around. I'm 65 and I am at the point where it's use it or lose it. It helps that I have a horse. She's an elderly horse herself. She's 23, will be 23 in March. I go out and I see her every day, weather and health dependent, and we go for a ride. It's not like it, I mean, 5 years ago, those rides were more centered on schooling and show preparation. These days, it's more about, well, you've got arthritis in your knees, horse, so maybe we need to just keep you moving.
I was going to say, you guys are keeping each other going. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it right there. But mm-hmm. another part is just getting out, doing my stretches, being aware of my ergonomics. I had a cataract develop last year. And that really, I mean, it just devastated. I was able to get books done, but that was about it. I did not have the mental energy to do promotion. That's pretty much taken over. So now I'm back to what I've done, which is I have a weekly moleskin planner and I kind of sit through and make weekly to-do lists. I actually took a writer organization class last week through Jane Friedman, and the person who did it said, I'm ADHD, and this is kind of aimed at that. And I went, oh, thank God, because I've never been formally diagnosed, but 10 years of working in special education, that went about halfway through, I had said something idly to my colleagues, both of whom had 30 years of experience behind them. I said, gee, I think I might be ADHD. They both gave me this look. It's a duh. Okay, that's the diagnosis. I don't need anything more. But there are some things that differ between neurodivergent and neurotypical and how you organize things. Neurotypical will run into these, but they can be bigger walls. Yeah. If you're neurodivergent, even the slightest bit. And some of that is just getting the initiative up to do it. You add age to that, and sometimes it just becomes, but one of the things that I've started adding into my routine as a result of that class was a weekly executive meeting where I just sit down, okay, what did I do last week? What did I accomplish? What do I need to do this coming week? What do I want to accomplish? And just kind of more creating a roadmap and just, okay, I have these things that I dropped last year because I couldn't see very well and it was a lot of effort. So now I need to go back and I need to take care of it. I need to get these books up on Ingram Spark. This book has been sitting on Amazon and I wanted to take it wide. I need to get it wide. I need to do that. You know, so it's being able to regroup and giving myself the permission to regroup and reorganize when life happens, because life happens.
Well, I noticed tellingly that you mentioned in that executive meeting that you said, what did I accomplish? Not what did I not accomplish? That's probably important, right? That you put an emphasis on the things that did get done, noting the things that still need to be done. But I thought that was interesting that, you know, it wasn't a review of your successes and failures. It was a review of what you did.
Right. Yeah. That was one of the good things that came out of this workshop was the person, and I don't have her name handy, but she just flat out said, don't call it, I'm getting organized. Or don't call it, I am organized. Call it, I am taking care of myself.
There you go.
I am providing self-care. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that and then went, I wish I'd had that perspective when I was teaching and working with middle school ADHD boys whose binders were a disaster, their lockers were a disaster. If I could just have said, hey, this is a matter of reducing your stress and taking care of yourself, I think it might have helped them.
I mean, I think that's anyone. People say, oh, you shouldn't rest on your laurels. Well, how about just accepting that your laurels are there that you could lean on now and then, you know, and we forget, you know, all of the things we've done, all of the things we've published, all of the reviews or that lovely email from a reader that comes in now and then. I think that's great. I think it's very important to recognize what's been done. And I agree, shifting perspective. I think we're all very pushed to be goal oriented. And you see it in these user group forums. So many posts, especially from newer writers or writers who might be a little further down on the ladder, are, is this good? Have I done enough? Can I be doing more? And that urge to compare ourselves, not just to others, but to the expectations that we think we should be, you know, using as a yardstick can be damaging. And to kind of rephrase it for ourselves, I think it's really important. And I mean, you know, the shorthand version of that, I suppose, would be focus on the process, not the goal. But it's it's an important distinction. And I love the regular check-ins. I think that's a great idea. I do a not religiously, but when I remember to, I do a similar thing. You know, I try on Sunday afternoon or Sunday night to kind of work out what's going to happen in the week to come so that, of course, so that nothing gets missed, but also to have a bit of a system, you know, have a little bit of structure so that, I mean, almost like, I don't know if you're an outliner or a pantser, but, you know, when in outlining, at least, you know, okay, I'm sitting down today and this is the scene that's next.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Back in the 90s, I was not writing fiction. I took the bad advice of somebody that I now realize saw me as a threat to her spouse, who was a rising mid-list writer at the time. And she said, go write nonfiction. Your nonfiction voice is better. Well, you know, I did a lot of writing for the Portland zine world, which meant that I had deadlines, managing deadline. And at the same time, my spouse was working 50 to 60 hours a week because that was the kind of job he had. And we had a young son who is autistic, and I had to organize because I had responsibilities.
do or die. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of do or die. At the time, I used a day runner. Right. And then when he got to a certain point, I went back to school and got a master's degree in special education and went to teaching in special education. I had to be organized in order to do well in special ed, especially since I got thrown in the deep end, because the first year at the job I spent 10 years at, I had 50 kids on my caseload.
Yikes.
And so what really helped is that the special ed department secretary sat down with me at the beginning and said, well, this is what we recommend you do. So I basically just started structuring things with, you know, my version of a tickler file and my binders and due dates. And so I turned around and started applying these structures in retirement to my writing. Okay, I need to set these timelines. Mm-hmm. I need to write it down somewhere so that I know I have to be doing this by this point to get to this point. And so most of the time it works. Sometimes it doesn't. Usually if it's failing, it's because of something I can't control, like a cataract.
Right.
That decided to erupt and become significant within a few months instead of a few years.
Yeah. And do these sort of self-imposed deadlines, are you enough of your own boss to make that work usually? Or do you use any external pressures like pre-orders or even just telling your mailing list, hey, this is coming by this date or anything like that?
I'm pretty much pretty good at self-managing that stuff. Part of it, though, again, has come from experience.
Yeah, you've trained yourself to listen to yourself.
Not only that, but I can kind of, I've written enough that I can say, okay, I'm at 30,000 words in this book. This needs to have happened by now. Mm-hmm. I'm at 60,000. This needs to have happened, and so on. So I have that structure. The other thing is that I know that barring things blowing up, I can do X amount of words in Y amount of time. Mm-hmm. So I have the ability to say, okay, I know that I can have this ready to go. And I don't publish my timelines. In fact, I'm notoriously poor at promotion in that respect because I don't do the 6 month in advance planning. I don't do the, this is going to be coming out soon. And here's the pre-order link. Because first of all, I've never really sold much on pre-order. And secondly, I'm really paranoid, especially after the last few months where you see somebody like Prince Harry having his pre-orders mucked up, or Mary Robinette Kuval. Mm-hmm. Of all people, having her pre-orders screwed up. And so I don't try to do a long lead time on pre-orders for that reason, because I just simply don't trust their systems. I don't trust Amazon systems. I don't trust Draft2Digital systems. I don't trust any of them.
The last time I did a pre-order kind of thing, I did my own. I waited until the first draft was done so that I knew, okay, you finished it, Matt. Everything else is just editing and all the rest as a self-publisher, right. You know, but the book is done. So you know, there's no worry that you're not going to finish it. So I announced a pre-order to my mailing list, which is it's a very modest mailing list, high engagement, small audience, you know, which I would almost rather have. I would rather, you know, 50% or more of the people that I talk to do something when I ask them to do it than not, you know, than have thousands who don't do something.
Right.
Yeah. And I just created a few packages with some bonus material, almost like my own Kickstarter, but it wasn't fund this or nothing will happen. It was, this is going to happen. And if you opt in now, you know, you'll get some extra little things and you'll get the book before it's released on Amazon, before it's released anywhere else. And for what I was aiming for, it was a success. It ended up basically paying for the original art that I commissioned for the cover and a little bit of the editing costs. Very small scale. I mean, it was high three digits, but that's all I needed. You know,
I mean, I have some plans. I would like to get to direct sales this year. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my goal, but getting there, because among other things, I need to set up the little technical pieces that I want to do and need to do.
Let me ask you this. Who's your mailing list provider?
I use Tiny Letter.
Tiny Letter. Okay. So I'm not as familiar with them. Many of the platforms have a built-in e-commerce solution. I use ConvertKit, and they have that. But even before I'm transitioning to using ConvertKit, because it integrates, as far as the direct sales, it integrates so well with the list itself. But even notwithstanding that, there's a company called Gumroad, which you've probably seen mentioned about. And as far as the electronic, your audiobook and your ebook and any kind mm-hmm. of like supplemental materials you might want to add, you know, as part of this incentive pre-order kind of situation. Yeah, they handle it all, and it integrates nicely with your website, as in you don't really even if you run a WordPress based site, there's a plugin you can get where somebody on your site just presses buy and the pop-up is basically coming from Gumroad, but it's everything that they need to put in their credit card and process the sale and get the thing. And you never leave your site, and emails are captured, and you can, you know, follow up with that person and all the rest. It's pretty darn easy to do direct sales these days. And yeah, of course, it's a little bit of a technical afternoon.
Yeah. Well, my website is woefully horrible. I mean, I've designed it all myself. Mm-hmm. And I am not. I was probably state of the art in the 90s.
That's when I started designing websites. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so I'm not particularly website design savvy, and WordPress does a good job.
And are you self-hosted WordPress, or are you at WordPress.com?
Self-hosted.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
I'm on DreamHost.
So am I. I've been with them for like 17 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, it's a spin-off. My son manages the whole, or it's one of his side ones. Mm-hmm. But I manage it all myself, and it's my domain and everything. So that part works, but it's still, you know, just the whole thing of setting up the different pages and coding it, making it look good, making the links work. And I think I'm using an outmoded. I set it up in the early teens, about 2011, and I haven't really upgraded it, and it shows.
Yeah, it can be a big job, but I think it's worth it, especially if you have a pretty responsive core group of fans, you know, a decent reader community. And once you do set it up, of course, that can become your primary thing that you promote is, you know, don't send people to Amazon, send people to the site. And, you know, but I understand completely that it's, do I write another book or do I spend months and months on this, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing too is that until recently, my best sales site has been Barnes & Noble.
Remarkable.
Yeah. This last year when I started putting things up on Kindle Vella was when I really started kind of doing well on Amazon. But I haven't had a Vella project up since August, and the Amazon sales have kind of trickled off since then. But I just got a bunch of sales on Apple, which I kind of went, whoa, how did that happen? You know, Draft to Digital throws promotions at me. I apply, and sure. I think it must have been a really broad spectrum of things that I had written. So I have no idea, but that's just kind of how this stuff goes.
Yeah.
It shows up on the dashboard. You go, how did that happen?
Yeah, indeed. And the trick is capturing those odd sales and hoping that they'll trickle over to your website and trickle onto your mailing list, and then you can sell to them again. But as we said earlier, it's a long game.
It's a very long game. I mean, my fantasy series, even now, I hadn't been pushing it the last 3 years because I've been pushing this Martini Air series, but still several times a year, somebody picks up one of the associated short stories.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden they pick up another one. before I know it, everything in that series has been bought. And I mean, there's enough books and enough short stories, but that's a nice little chunk of change.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody just discovered me and bought everything in that one series. How did they find out? I've never really been able to coordinate it with any particular promotion. There for a while, when I first got on Twitter, I would be tweeting about the Martini Air books because it wasn't until 2020, and I get sales. And then that ended. I figure you have to reinvent yourself about every 3 to 4 months.
I think of it as being an experienced beginner. Everything is changing so constantly that there's always going to be something new to learn, something new to try, something that worked last week that doesn't work anymore. And I think the only constant is creating a good connected engagement, a good relationship with the readers.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the only, but how that happens and how that's done, how the first step is done, how the first date is booked.
Yeah.
That's constantly changing and shifting.
It really is. I mean, yeah. I have 3 Substacks going right now. One is more of my general blogging, although it's become more of a writer blog. And of late, it seems to be getting more interest. I'm serializing the latest Martini Air book on Martini Air stories. And then there's my political writing things, because occasionally I get up there and say, okay, I have a degree in political science. I have all of these years of political organizing history. You know, I'm at least as qualified as these wankers who are sounding off. And
what use is a platform if you don't get up on it now and then? Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't do that very much. And one of the things I wanted to do was, I had written back in 1980, when I was getting my poli-sci degree, I'd written a couple of studies of local right-wing Christian organizing, and I thought it would be relevant for the current day. I have one paper up. I haven't gotten the other one up. And then I have a whole file of old material collected from the 80s and 90s, so it shows a very distinct through line to the modern day.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
But I haven't really had the energy to put into that. So,
well, yeah, hey, if nothing else, you have all your research done for a period piece political thriller.
I have a story. Problem is,
people are still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did I know?
Yeah, that's kind of. And considering some of the, it's easy right now. It is easier to take those situations and put them in the far future.
There you go. Yep. Mm-hmm. Which is tried and true. Yes. That's how we do it. Keep those notes under lock and key. They'll be of use one day. So to kind of bring us around to a close, you know, obviously the podcast, the listeners are kind of all over the place in terms of their level of expertise, where they are in their careers. Most of them are writers, but all of them are creators in one form or another. And so as difficult as it might be to distill, I don't want your advice for them, but what is the sort of the core guiding principle or lesson that you yourself have learned, have figured out, have gleaned that drives you day to day, that keeps you going, that helps you progress down the road towards your own goals?
I think being aware that nothing is static, whether you're talking fiber arts, which I dabble in that, I make quilts. One of my fans has bought 2 of my lap quilts. I've made jewelry. I've done the writing, but the reality is it's not just the fad, but it's the process and the business that changes and can change very rapidly. And being willing to learn and adapt and change as the technology changes, as the circumstances changes. Too many people tend to get locked into, well, this is the way I've always done it. This is the way that it always has to be done. Well, you know what? Things like COVID happen. Things like 9/11 happen. Wars happen. you have to just kind of suck it up and go along with what the change. I mean, your main means of support may blow up in your face. You may lose a job. You may lose housing. You have to be willing to learn and adapt. And that doesn't change no matter what, no matter how high you go. You have to be willing to do it.
The only thing for certain is uncertainty, as my dad used to say.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have to be willing to work with that. You have to be willing to deal with that. And you have to have flexibility because Lord only knows I have been on the brink of, oh, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. And then somebody gets sick. Or like I was going to have my big local breakthrough with a targeted local book, a lovely little urban fantasy that I'm kind of like reluctant to do much with because it's now out of fashion. And a week before I was supposed to do my reading, the roof fell in on the bookstore.
Oh, the literal roof fell in on the bookstore.
The literal roof fell in.
Well, I guess better then than the day you were there, but
And, you know, stuff happened and then COVID happened and then things just kept piling up. So,
yeah, but no, I think that's great. Timely and also timeless advice is just remain flexible. I mean, everything always takes longer than we expect. Everything unexpected is expected. And the only thing we can consistently do is to keep trying, right? I won't say stick to the path because the path is going to change and the terrain is going to change right under your feet now and then, but at least keep stepping forward, you know?
And a lot of times, the changes end up making things better in the long run. That's
right. In ways we couldn't have expected. Indeed. This has been great. I think you've provided a lot of value for the listeners. I'm excited to be able to share this with them. And I hope it was a good conversation for you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Hey, if you've enjoyed this or any other episode of Sonitotum, I've got three things that I would love for you to do for me to help show your support for the show. The first thing is, if you haven't already, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, please subscribe for free to Sonitotum. Just click that subscribe button for Sonitotum wherever it is that you might have heard this episode, wherever it is you get your podcasts. Next, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, I hope you'll take just a moment to rate and review Sonitotum. Tell the world why you enjoy the show and why other people should listen to it and subscribe for free. And finally, if you'd like to go the extra mile, you have the will and the means, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron of Sonitotum and my other creative endeavors. For just $5 a month, not only will you be a member of the Multiversalists community of writers and readers and creators, you will receive all kinds of special access, perks, and exclusive content, not least of which is the uncut, unproduced edition of every episode of Sonitotum. Just go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron or visit patreon.com/mattselznick and pledge just $5 a month to support the show through your patronage. That's it. If you can do one or two or all three of those things, you'll be really helping the show and helping me reach more people with the Sonitotum mission of making stuff, finding success, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Thanks. Well, dear listener, I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joyce Reynolds Ward. We covered a lot of ground, and I hope there was a lot that you took away from it. I would love your feedback on the conversation with Joyce Reynolds Ward or anything else you heard in this episode or anything you hear in any episode of Sonitotum. If you would like to comment specifically on this episode, you can go to mattselznick.com/sonitotum-075 and scroll down and you'll find the comments section there. Leave a comment there. I will reply, of course. And if you've got a comment for Joyce regarding the show, you can leave it there as well. And I'll make sure she finds out about it, hears about it. If you would like to simply email me your comments about this or any other episode, you can write matt@mattselznick.com. That's matt@mattselznick.com. matt@mattselznick.com. Or if you like, you could even record a little voice message on your phone and email me that at matt@mattselznick.com. If you just send me an email, I will reply to you, of course. And if you send me a little voice message, well, I'll include that in a future episode and reply to you in the episode. And we'll have a sort of time-shifted conversation and you will become part of the show, which is neat. Again, I would love your feedback. At the beginning of the show, I say we talk about making stuff, finding success and staying healthy and staying in the process. And that we is you and me, dear listener. You and I, we make up this community. You're here as a listener every week, and I appreciate you so much. I would love to hear from you and find out what you think about what I've been doing here on the show and what you've heard. Let's thank all of my member patrons who contribute $5 a month to support this show and the efforts that go into making this show and all of my other creative endeavors. They are Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. You heard a little bit ago about how you can become a multiversalist for just $5 a month. There are so many perks that you can receive, and you become part of the community. Anyway, thank you to Chuck, Amy, J.C., and Ted, and I hope to see you, dear listener, joining in that community. It takes an awful lot of work to put together these interview episodes. I sure hope you appreciate them, and I really hope they are of value to you. I'll be back for episode 76, which will be one of our non-interview shows where I will talk to you about either making stuff or finding success or staying healthy and sane. I'll see you then. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.